Accession number 20968, Real 1.
This is an interview with Eric Pitt on November the 28th, 2000, recorded by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Sorry?
Can we just put on the record when you were born, Eric, and where?
Yes, I was born in Titherington, a small village in South Gloucestershire, which is not too far away from Bristol, and I was born 9/9/1926, and I went to the local village school, and then on from there to the grammar school in Thornbury. We passed the entrance exam for that. I was in Thornbury Grammar School all during the war. Spent a lot of our time in the air raid shelters at the school, but I did manage to get my what they called a school leaving certificate, Bristol University school leaving certificate in 1943, that would be. And then for a short time I did a job in the local quarry where my father worked. I took up engineering, but at the age of 18, or just beyond 18, I was called up for the Navy. And in fact, I went to Royal Arthur Skegness, November 1944, and a series of tests at Royal Arthur, and I was categorized to, and went into the Fleet Air Arm. So the next step was a draft to HMS Gadwell, Gosling, which was near Warrington. We did our square bashing there, and then following that, obviously there was a course to do, and as I was in air mechanic engines, I went to Hennesford, which was an RAF base which trained Fleet Air Arm as well.
You chose to do that, did you, or were you told to do it? The job, the trade?
Well, they suggested that I would be an engine, because I'd been to an engineering job for a few months, and they suggested that I would make air mechanic engines. So that was the course for 6 months. VE Day came while I was on the course, and also VJ Day. However, I was transferred following my course, which successfully got through, and went to Belfast, which was HMS Gadwell. And there I worked on, started working on Corsairs and Wildcats and Hellcats, which came under the lease lend from America. Very nice aeroplanes. They were very good aeroplanes. So after, then on the March 46, I was posted to 811 Squadron, which was Mosquitoes. We had some of the ex-RAF Mosquitoes, Mosquito 4, and then our own version, the Sea Mosquito. And I worked on those until 1948, by which time I decided, although I was getting near release, I decided that I rather liked the Fleet Air Arm, the job I was doing, and took advantage of a bounty scheme which they brought in, which was for a 4-year period. And a little bit of money, not big money, but... So I stayed there until, I think it was about 1948, October 48, and then I went up to HMS Fulmar, which is at Lossiemouth in Scotland. And actually I went to Milltown, which was a small airfield nearby, and the aircraft there were, it was 767 Squadron, which is a training squadron, Seafarers and Fireflies. We eventually transferred the squadron down to HMS Heron at Yeovilton, and from there we did some training on my first aircraft carrier, HMS Illustrious. The squadron went out, flew out from Yeovilton, and the Illustrious was off Portland, Weymouth, and they did some deck landings there. We were on the Illustrious for about a week. Then back to...
How did you embark? You got on her in port, did you, or what?
We went down...
You didn't land on or anything?
No, I didn't. No, the mechanics went first by train down to Weymouth, Portland, and we were transferred on to the aircraft carrier at Portland's naval base. And we did... went out into the channel, obviously, and the pilots did their deck landing. And a very sad instance there. One of the pilots that I was... we had our own aircraft, more or less, to maintain. Unfortunately, he missed the wire and went into the barrier and lost his life. Very sad to know a pilot very well. And because we used to help them strap them in, obviously, into the aircraft.
And was that in a Seafarer?
Yes, it was a Seafarer. Very, very sad. Anyway, back to Yeovilton for a while after that, until with the Korean War had started, and I was posted on... I was posted from Yeovilton to the aircraft carrier Ocean, which was in Plymouth, and that was on the April 1950, by which time the Korean War had started. So the Ocean was being used to ferry out troops and aircraft and general stores. We went up to Glasgow to pick up some Seafarer 47s, and we set sail from Glasgow about the 18th of April 1950. The first stop was Malta, where we picked up supplies. Then we went on Port Said, Aden, Trincomalee, Singapore, and up to Hong Kong. I was posted ashore in Hong Kong. Kai Tak was the airfield there. And we just had a tent to live in, and we were picking up the aircraft which were coming back from Korea, which been damaged, etc. And after a short while in Hong Kong, the main base then was going to be HMS Sembawang, which was Sembawang in Singapore. So we picked up the Ocean on the way back and were transferred to Singapore and ashore to HMS Sembawang. HMS Sembawang was very close to HMS Terror, the dockyard. So what happened, the aircraft were taken from the carriers in the dockyard and towed up to the naval base at Sembawang, which wasn't very far away.
Well, on lighters, were they?
They had a special adapter to do it. Mm-hmm. It was got it here. Sort of a low loader thing, anyway.
Oh, on land, was it?
Sorry?
On shore. They
yes.
Towed on shore.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was towed along the roads nearby the airfield. Mm-hmm. Got it here somewhere for a while.
Or we can sort that.
There it is.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Sort of a jeep affair, and towed on its own wheels.
Yeah. Mm.
While at Sambuang, I worked on Sea Furies and Fireflies. They were then taken by Unicorn, which was a naval repair vessel, really. It wasn't one of the operational carriers. So some of us were drafted on to the Unicorn to look after the aircraft. And the general day-to-day maintenance. And the aircraft were taken up to Japan. There were a couple of places in Japan. There was Sasebo, which was a main base, and Kure. And then they were transferred to whichever carrier was operational at that time. The carriers did about 6 months, and then that was the end of it. They were relieved by another carrier. In fact, we had one, the Sydney, which was the Australian carrier, came up for a period of 6 months. So I was roughly 2.5 years in the Far East, and in our spare time we played plenty of football, and tennis. We had all the facilities, swimming, so it wasn't all work.
This was mainly at Singapore, was it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm. The base had its own swimming pool, football pitches, and so we did have a little bit of leisure. Of course, we were able to go into Singapore, but Singapore was perhaps a little problem because there was the communists in the jungle, which came down occasionally to Singapore, and so we had to be very careful, on our guard all the time in Singapore. Some of the members of the Fleet Air Arm were allowed to go up to Penang for a period of a holiday period, but on the train from Singapore up to Kuala Lumpur, they were issued with rifles, and just in case, because sometimes the trains had been known to be attacked by the communists out there. So after
you didn't experience any.
No, I didn't take that trip. But
Tell me, did Singapore at that time, were there still any scars left from the Japanese occupation that you could see? Or there was that terrible camp at Changi, wasn't it, which presumably
that's right. No, I didn't see anything. I can't recollect seeing anything in particular. A lot of rebuilding had been done in Singapore because this was, 44? We were now looking at 1950. 54, so they had
that
done
9 years, isn't it?
Yes, they'd done quite a lot there.
Yeah.
So 2.5 years in Singapore. I liked the climate, a little bit sticky, but it was very hot working in the hangars. I've known the time when the sweat has been rolling off me and it's been trickling down the main train, I suppose, but.
Can you tell me a bit about your work now? I mean, you worked on quite a variety of engines, didn't you?
I have done, yeah. The aircraft coming back from Korea had some bullet holes in them, and they bent props and damaged undercarriages and things. We did what we could. As an engine mechanic, I worked on Sea Furies and Fireflies. Sea Fury was a radial engine. It had a Centaurus sleeve valve, very
air-cooled,
very good engine. Yeah, 18 cylinders, and a very fast airplane. You're looking at 400, 450 miles for a piston engine per hour, which is very good. And in fact, it was noted that one Sea Fury shot down a MiG, but I think that was about the only time. But it did happen.
How did the Centaurus compare with the American radials? What were they, Pratt & Whitney's?
Yes, American were, yes, Pratt & Whitney engines.
Were they very different?
Well, the Centaurus was a sleeve valve, what they call a sleeve valve, which a much more sophisticated engine. But working on aeroplanes, you soon get used to what had to be done. Probably the Firefly, which was an inline engine, was probably more accessible than the radial. You'd have to, for plug changes and things like that, obviously with a radial you were underneath, up the side, on the top, but with an inline engine you were along the side of the engine, probably easier to maintain. Mm-hmm. But
what about engine changes? I mean, were the radials quicker to change than the inlines or not?
No, I think roughly about the same. Mm. Roughly about the same time to do an engine change.
Did they have any characteristic snags? You know, was there something always going wrong on the Centaurus, or always going wrong on, was it the grip?
No, the Centaurus was a very reliable engine. Mm. Very reliable. And whereas on some radios you would have what's known as a pot change, but I can't recollect.
Cylinder head, is it an individual cylinder head? The pot.
Yes,
plane.
Yes. Mm. But no, it was a very successful aeroplane. And
what was the sort of damage on the engines themselves? Was there much battle damage ever, or was it mainly the props that got bent?
Yes, it was mainly the pilots that had broken them, coming into the barrier, and of course that didn't do the prop any good, mm. And undercarriages had been broken, but and a few bullet holes, obviously. But we did what we could to, the engine change, undercarriage change, we could do all those sort of things in Singapore.
How did your work differ from the work of the engine fitters actually on the carriers? More main maintenance on them?
Yes, on the carriers they would just do the engine oil checks and refuel. Not very involved maintenance, but of course the maintenance at Singapore was it was an overhaul where plug changes, engine changes and all those sort of things had to be done. So much inspection had to be done on the engines, which wasn't done on the carriers, obviously. They didn't have time. They would just refuel and do the necessary. And
of course, you had all the necessary equipment in the workshops.
Yes,
hoists and things
we had all the hoists and cranes, and the staging to get around the aircraft. Yes, we had all that. We were very well organised there.
Yeah,
but of course, that was you term it heavy maintenance, and whereas on the carrier they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't have time.
Yeah. Apart from an engine change, though, I mean, you mentioned a pop change on a Centaurus or something like that. What were the other pieces of maintenance that you often had to do on any of the engines?
Well, we'd have to retime the magnetos and things like that. It was all planned inspection. Check the oil filters and change the oil filters and fuel filters, all those sort of things.
Do you have to take the heads off at all on the inlines? Very often?
Yes, because there were the clearances in... Yes, yeah, you would have to...
So you often had to put new rings on the pistons, for instance, did you, and this sort of thing?
Because
they were down on compression.
Yes, you would do compression checks, what they're known as compression checks, and check everything through. So it was... there was always plenty of work to do, plenty of work.
Now, I've looked, I think, at the Merlin in the Science Museum, and particularly on the gear train, you know, from the supercharger up and through. I mean, that must have been a nightmare to sort of take down and put together again.
That's right, but of course we wouldn't deal with that too often.
No.
Occasionally, yes,
You spent some time in Japan, you mentioned, did you?
Yes, I did, and
how did you find that?
I took the opportunity to go along to Hiroshima.
Mm.
Had a bit of shore leave, and of course they were rebuilding Hiroshima at that time, but it was awful devastation.
Much hostility from the Japanese people?
None whatsoever. Mm. No.
Because they were in uniform, I suppose.
Yes,
they?
Yeah. We went into the shops and bought things. I bought a nice tea set, which I brought home with me. But... No, there was no hostility at that time at all. But it was, I suppose one could say that it was a terrible thing to happen, but it did bring the war to a close much more quickly than had been ever thought about, I think. But a terrible thing.
What was Kaitak like in those days?
Kaitak was a civilian airfield as well. And it was nice to see the BOAC planes coming in, the Constellations at that time, bringing in the mail from home. We always knew when some mail was due. The RAF, we had our meals and etc. From the RAF, but all we had was a big tent on the airfield. So it was a civilian airfield as well, and it was nice to see BOAC coming in.
And of course it hadn't got the extension built in those days.
No, it hadn't built the runway. They've now got a runway which goes out quite a way into the sea.
Well, they had. It's closed now, hasn't it?
Well, yes, they've built another airfield now, which is some way away, I gather.
Yeah. Yes. I've often flown in and out of Hong Kong in later years, as you probably have.
Yes.
You know, that terrifying approach through the washing lines.
Yeah, around those mountains. Yes. Yeah.
So you were out at Kai Tak. Did you get a chance to get to the island at all? Or?
Yes, we had a look at Hong Kong over on the Kowloon ferry. Mm. We did have time for a little bit of swimming as well, which was a little way from Kai Tak. We used to have to go up over the mountains and down over the other side. But things at that time were very cheap in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong dollar was about a shilling, I think, equivalent. Whereas Singapore, which was double that, was about 2 shillings or so.
What was your pay at that time? Do you remember?
Not very much. I think the pay to start off was about 8 shillings a day.
Yeah.
It did increase a little, but it was still a matter of shillings, not many pounds, the old pounds.
And you had nappy facilities out at Kai Tak, did you? Or?
We had the RAF facilities. Yeah. We had the I think it was a nappy there.
Yeah.
We always found a nappy. Mm. But of course there were very good places ashore. There was the Union Jack Club in Hong Kong.
That was on Hong Kong Island, was it?
Yes, yes, that was on the island. I rather liked Hong Kong. In fact, it was nice to go and see these places.
Mm. You mentioned earlier on the Sea Hornets you worked on. I mean, they were lovely aeroplanes, weren't they?
Yes, yeah, they had a Merlin engine.
Yeah.
Sea Mosquitoes mainly, although there was the Sea Hornet as well, but it was another version, I think.
And you mentioned the Seafire with the contra-rotating prop.
Seafire 47. Yes.
Now, presumably the gearbox for those props was quite elaborate, was it?
Yes, we didn't get very involved with those because at this stage, although they were on the Triumph, which was the original carrier, in the Korean War, the first one out there. We didn't have a lot to do with those because it was then superseded by the Sea Fury and the Fireflies. Mm. But they certainly used them in Korea to start with.
Mm. So when did you come back from the Far East?
1952. Mm-hmm. And for my last few months, because although my time had expired, because of the Korean War, they weren't releasing any mechanics. We were retained for a further period. But eventually, so I came back to Leon Solent for a short while, then up to Black Cap, which was Warrington. And again, I was on Seafires and Fireflies. But I also did a course down at Yelverton on what's the Wyvern, which had a Python engine, which was a sort of a prop with a jet, sort of a
gas turbine.
Yes. Mm. And it didn't operate a great deal, but I was on that original Wyvern, which was a Westland aircraft. Mm. And then I was released in July 1953, came back home, and at that time, do you want this? Mm. At that time, I saw an advertisement for engine fitters at BOAC at Filton near Bristol. So I went along, and obviously because of my experience in the fleet air arm on engines, I was taken on as an engine fitter to work on Constellations and Stratocruisers at that time.
Back to the big radials then?
Yes, mm. Yeah. And much bigger aeroplanes, obviously. Mm. Stratocruisers and Constellations used to carry roughly 100 passengers. And from there, I went up to we were transferred to Heathrow, which was opening up then, and which had been a wartime airfield.
This would have been, what, about 54?
This was 54, yes, 1954. Mm. And I've seen tremendous change at Heathrow since then. Aircraft as well. The next aircraft I worked on after the...
Now, you're at Heathrow, and yeah. It was still, so to speak, London Airport North, wasn't it?
That's right.
The old Nissen Hudson Tent.
That's right. We're still on the north side. That's yeah. Where the aircraft departed from, yeah. On the north side. And then they opened up the central area, which was Terminal 1, and they went on to Terminal 2, Terminal 3, eventually Terminal 4, and now they're thinking about Terminal 5 now. Mm. So... I saw tremendous change at Heathrow, and I worked on, to start with, the Stratocruisers and Constellations, then went on to the Bristol Britannia, and after the Britannia we had the Comet 4s back again by then. The Comet 1s had been obviously not very satisfactory.
Did you work on the Comet 1s before?
No, I worked on the Comet 4. Mm. And which had been strengthened. The problem was around the passenger door, I gather. So, but the Comet 4 went on to be a very successful aircraft. Following the Comet 4, I went on to 707s, which was Boeing 707. Then the VC-10, which is a British, very successful aircraft with the four engines on the tail section. Following that, I went on to the Concorde, and also worked on 737s, 727s, and other aircraft for other airlines, which British Airways, by then not BOAC anymore, with the amalgamation of British European and BOAC, it became British Airways. And
you on the Trident as well, I suppose?
No, it's one aircraft I didn't work on, was the Trident.
Yeah, yeah.
But I worked on all the aircraft that were associated with BOAC, which by then was Terminal 4. 747? 747, yes.
The great big JT9s.
Yes, yeah.
That was quite an experience, wasn't it?
Yes. After all when I first saw 747 land at Heathrow, I thought, goodness gracious, the size of this aeroplane. However can we work on that after it dwarfed the 707 or the VC-10, but we felt nothing of it eventually, that such a big aeroplane. And
but the change in thrust, I mean, what was it, the Avons on the Comet were about 5,000 pounds, and on
yeah.
The 747 went up to about, what, 70,000, didn't it? 55 and up to 70.
Yes, I would,
yeah.
Yes, around about there.
Huge change.
Huge aeroplanes, but of course Rolls-Royce. Our jumbos had Rolls-Royce in, and so I think I cannot say that I saw a lot of the world with the fleet air arm, and I've also seen a lot more with BOAC, British Airways, and I felt I always wanted to do that, and of course I learnt my trade in the fleet air arm, and that put me in very good stead for the rest of my days, working days, and I've now been retired 11 years, and I have a lot to be thankful for.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Eric. Okay.